This is STD Podcast. In the real world of STD prevention rubric of the November issue of the journal Sexually Transmitted Diseases, an article appeared that examines the intersection of two emerging issues in the control of sexually transmitted infections. That is, the increasing use of expedited partner therapy for the management of partners of persons with gonorrhea and chlamydia on the one hand, and the growing importance of federally qualified health centers for the provision of STD management on the other. Because expedited partner therapy, or EPT, has been demonstrated to reduce the transmission of chlamydia and gonorrhea, widespread adoption of this prevention strategy by an increasingly important provider of STD care may have significant impact on STD control in the United States. Here to discuss the paper is Dr. Julia Schillinger, who is a medical officer in the Division of STD Prevention at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. She is stationed in New York City, where she is the Director of Surveillance, Epidemiology, and Research in the Bureau of STD Control, New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. She has extensive experience in STD research and was the lead author of a randomized control trial that demonstrated the efficacy of EPT for chlamydial infections, published a little more than 10 years ago. Welcome to the podcast, Julie.
Thanks, Case. Glad to be here.
So a lot has happened in the area of EPT since your article was first published. CDC and many states have endorsed the use of EPT, and the question now really is one of adoption at the clinic level. Please tell us what your study entailed and what the findings were.
Sure. Just a bit of background on EPT in New York State, because I think it's important context. EPT for chlamydia has been legal in New York State since 2010, and the law allows EPT to be given as either medication in hand or a prescription for medication. The law does require that providers give index patients educational materials, not only for the index patient, but to be delivered to their partners. And the law further specifies the content of those educational materials. We did this survey among federally qualified health centers, and I'm sure many of the listeners are familiar with the mandate of federally qualified health centers, which is to serve underserved populations, underinsured and uninsured. And at the time that we did this survey, there were 29 federally qualified health centers in New York City serving more than 1.4 million New Yorkers. We did a two-tier survey to measure both policy and practice surrounding EPT. The first tier was a survey that was aimed at measuring policy at the organizational level of a federally qualified health center. And to do that, we surveyed the medical directors of all the New York City federally qualified health centers, or FQHCs. We called these parent entities because they are the organizational hubs for what were sometimes quite large networks of clinics. When we surveyed the medical directors, we asked about EPT policies as well as some other STD diagnosis and management practices. And we asked for the names of the federally qualified health center's clinical sites where the largest number of adolescents were served, as well as where they serve the largest number of patients for reproductive health and HIV care. And we further asked about the person at each one of those named sites that would be most knowledgeable about STD practices. Then for our second tier, we surveyed those sites organizations had appointed us to, and there we surveyed the provider that we knew to be the most knowledgeable based on what we had learned on the entity-level survey. And for this survey, which again was at the clinic level, we were really interested in measuring practice. So the higher level survey was around the policy that may exist, and here we were interested in how that plays out. On this survey, we asked about whether EPT was done by the clinic, the groups for whom EPT was provided, whether it was done by prescription or medication, and whether educational materials were provided as would be required by law. We also asked about obstacles to practicing EPT. So the main findings from our entity-level survey, which again was centered around policy, was that the majority, 76% of the entities responded. So we got responses from 22 of the 29 FQHCs. And these 22 sites, organizations, I should say, served 1.2 million patients. The majority of FQHCs, 55%, reported that they had a written policy permitting EPT, and none had a written policy that prohibited EPT. Among those that didn't have a written policy, 70% said it was because a policy wasn't needed because EPT was legal. The majority of written policies allowed EPT to be provided to male and female adolescents and adults and to patients with opposite sex and same-sex sex partners. Only 17% of the federally qualified health centers with written policy dispensed EPT as medication only. 25% allowed it to be dispensed either as medication or by prescription. But very importantly, 33% said that they only allowed EPT to be dispensed by prescription. 96% of the entities said that they had an electronic health record. And among the federally qualified health centers without a written policy, 4 cited limitations with their electronic health record as a reason that they lacked the policy. So that was what we found at the high organizational level. Then when we looked at what we learned from surveying the actual clinical sites where care is provided, we got responses from 70%, which represented more than 90,000 patient visits a year. And we found that the majority, 80% of the sites, provided EPT. Interestingly, sites that were part of an organization with a written policy were slightly more likely to practice EPT than those belonging to entities that did not have a written policy, 86% versus 70%. But that was not statistically significant. As might be expected from what we learned was contained in the written policies, we found that at the clinic level, EPT was provided to adolescents and to adults with opposite and same-sex partners. And we learned that 58% of the clinical sites were providing EPT by prescription only. Interestingly, 1/3 of the sites reported that they did not provide educational materials with EPT, despite the fact that this is required by law. And among those sites not providing EPT, reasons that were cited included clinical concerns, limitations of the electronic health record, financial barriers, and 2 of these clinical sites were not aware that EPT was legal. So in short, what we were able to document was widespread utilization of EPT. We did identify some potential obstacles to EPT reaching partners, most notably the widespread use of prescriptions for EPT. And we also found some departures from recommended and even regulated use of EPT, and here I refer to the lack of provision of education materials, which points to a need for us to work more closely with FQHCs to optimize the practice of EPT.
As you stated in the manuscript, federally qualified health centers may be playing an increasingly important role in the delivery of SD services under the Affordable Care Act. So given the potential for EPT to decrease chlamydia transmission, widespread adoption of this practice, as it seems like coming out of your study, could have very significant prevention effects. Is that a fair conclusion?
I think it is fair, but I think we have to remember that EPT was designed to reduce rates of repeat chlamydial infection in index patients, and that's what the randomized controlled trials showed EPT did. It would be great if EPT also decreased chlamydial transmission on a population level, but that has not been shown. It would be wonderful, and I'm hopeful. I mean, I think our study findings, because of the widespread adoption of EPT by these FQHC, and because of the fact that FQHC serves such a large number of New Yorkers, and that they report about to us about 8,000 cases of chlamydia a year, which is about 13% of our city's chlamydia, I would think that would make a dent on the long-term sequelae attributable to repeat chlamydial infection. Every single one of those chlamydia cases were given EPT. But as to whether or not it will measurably decrease ongoing transmission on the population level, I'm not sure. I'm hopeful, but I think with time and increased uptake throughout our city, we may see some impact there and be able to measure it.
Now, you indicated in your study that most clinics provide prescriptions rather than dispense medications directly. Most of the studies, including yours, provided medications directly. What may be the downside of providing prescriptions?
Well, the downside is that prescriptions may introduce additional obstacles to EPT reaching the sex partner. And if so, then EPT via prescription may not be as effective as by medication. This is an unknown. But what we do know is that when EPT is dispensed as medication, there's only one step in getting that medication to a sex partner. The index patient needs to deliver it to the sex partner. But when EPT is dispensed as a prescription, there are more steps involved. First, the prescription needs to get to the pharmacy. Second, someone, either the index patient or the partner, needs to go to the pharmacy to fill the prescription. And third, if the partner does not have prescription coverage, someone needs to pay for the medication. We have surveyed pharmacies in New York City about the cost of a generic 1 gram dose of azithromycin, and prices can range from as little as, say, $5 to $7 to more than $50 for a single 1 gram dose. Many teenagers would have a hard time paying that much, let alone adults. And even if they have the money, they may not choose to fill a prescription that is that expensive. So these are really potential obstacles to the EPT reaching the sex partner when prescriptions are used.
Yeah. Well, to follow up on that question, what do you think are some of the barriers that providers have providing medications directly?
Well, I think it's probably mostly cost. I think that, you know, we're talking here about treating, from the clinic's perspective, potentially treating someone who's not within their catchment. It's very arguable that doing so will reduce repeat infection in their own patient, the one who is in their system. But I don't know that this is always viewed that way by the organizations that are providing care. And so I would think that it came down to cost, mm-hmm. the ability to have sort of medication on the shelves that you could give to index patients.
Right.
I think we need to do more work to come up with strategies to get really low-cost azithromycin distributed to places that have a high volume of chlamydia patients who would benefit from EPT.
Mm-hmm. Now, the other thing from your study, the data are derived from interviews with providers about their clinic policies and practices. Are there any patient-level data that you have that kind of corroborate the results? In other words, do clinics that have a stated practice, does that translate into patients actually receiving the scripts or the medicines for that matter?
Right. Well, you know, in the year before we did this survey, we did work with a single very large FQHC in New York City who was included in this subsequent survey. We worked with them to modify their electronic health record to add a set of questions around EPT so that they would be able to monitor whether a patient was offered and accepted EPT. And so in that particular FQHC, we could see from subsequent data that they provided that patients were indeed getting EPT. About 65% of those who were offered it accepted it. I would say, you know, yes, we didn't interview the patients themselves, but this was data that was drawn from their electronic medical record.
Well, actually, interestingly, you also brought up that one of the barriers to providing EPT was actually related to electronic health records. So what is that about? And how can we fix that problem?
Yeah, well, you know, some electronic health record systems work by generating paper prescriptions. I mean, the doctor sits in front of the computer, and then when it comes time to generate a prescription, sends it to the printer, and it comes out, and it's handed directly to the patient. Other EHR, electronic health record systems, you know, transmit prescriptions electronically to pharmacies. But regardless of which of those systems one's working with, most of these systems, and maybe even all, can generate prescriptions only for people who are in their system. So providers, you know, couldn't use an electronic health record system to generate a prescription for a partner who's not already in their system. They can't get the computer to spit it out with a name on it if that person is not already a patient in their system. Some providers might try to get around this problem by writing a prescription for the partner under the name of the index patient. And I think that's an approach that's been used for many, many years in the past, well before we had electronic health records. But this really can't be done or shouldn't be done because it could be considered insurance fraud by the prescription plan for the index patient. As for these problems with the EHRs, there are two main workarounds that I'm aware of. The first is really simple, and that is really just to use paper prescriptions when providing EPT. Get a prescription pad and use that even if your electronic health record won't spit one out. That won't remove the obstacles to filling the prescription that we were discussing just a few minutes ago, but at least you can get a prescription out that way. And the other approach, which is more of a technical one, is to work with the system administrator to create a so-called dummy patient in the electronic health record that you can use to generate paper prescriptions for a partner. So that dummy patient could have the name EPT partner. And whenever you need to generate an EPT prescription, you could go in there and register it as an encounter and print out the prescription.
I see. And this is done in some of the health centers.
I have heard from some facilities in New York that they've taken this approach.
So finally, the paper really limits its evaluation of EBT for chlamydia. A number of studies, particularly the one from Dr. Matt Gull in Seattle, showed that EBT was actually more effective for the prevention of reinfection with gonorrhea. So what is the status of EBT for gonorrhea in New York?
EBT is not legal for gonorrhea in New York State. We introduced the law for chlamydia only because we were concerned even back in 2008 when we really started working on it. We were concerned even then about the impending emergence of cephalosporin resistance among Neisseria gonorrhea. And for that reason, we didn't want a law in the books that allowed dispensing of oral cephalosporins to partners.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us, and congratulations on the paper.
Thanks, Case. Glad to be here.
Dr. Julia Schillinger is the Director of Surveillance, Epidemiology, and Research in the Bureau of STD Control, New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. The paper is entitled Expedited Partner Therapy in Federally Qualified Health Centers. The lead author of the manuscript is Dr. Camille Introcaso, and co-authors include Megan Rogers, Sharon Abbott, Rachel Goritz, and Laurie Markovich. The senior author is Dr. Julie Schillinger, who was with us today to discuss the paper's findings. SD Podcast is produced by Ben Westergaard for the Internet and SD Center of Excellence. This is Case Rietmeyer for SD Prevention Online.